Welcome to Missing and Not Forgotten, the official podcast of the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency. I'm Sean Everett, DPAA's Media Relations Chief and your host. Thank you for joining us.
On this episode, we're going to talk to Ray Capon, the nephew of Chaplain Emil Capon, who we've talked about for the last couple of episodes now. Ray, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
No problem. We've been talking about your uncle, Chaplain Emil Capon, for a couple of episodes now. We talked to Dr. Don Berry, one of our historians who worked on the case, and we have talked to Dr. Veronica Keyes and Kristen Groh, who are respectively the outgoing and the incoming Korean War Identification Project leads and scientists who have worked on this case. But now we want to hear about Father Capon from his family perspective. So tell me a little bit about him.
You know, he was definitely a Kansas country boy. I mean, you know, he grew up out by Pilsen, Kansas, about 2 miles outside of Pilsen. And Pilsen really is if you talk about a small town, it would be smaller than that. I mean, it's a typical Midwest small town with a huge Catholic church and maybe 10 homes. But the community is just a very, very tight community, very, very heavy in the Catholic church and very heavy in the Czechoslovakia background. And as I said, he grew up out there, and as time went on, I mean, my grandma always said that he knew what his vocation was. He knew where he was wanting to be. He knew he wanted to be a priest, even from a very, very early age. So it was no surprise to anyone, including my parents and my dad, that is where his life would be led. He ended up going to a seminary and became a priest, and was actually being the priest out at Pilsen. I mean, it was his hometown parish, which was great in a lot of ways, but in a lot of ways for Father, it was kind of a double-edged sword for him, because he grew up around all those people out in Pilsen, Kansas, and all the old farmers and all the older people and all the kids that he went to school with. So you can imagine some trepidation that he had when now he's all of a sudden the parish priest, and here he is hearing confession to these kids he knew in school, and to these old timers who are like, you know, you're a punk little kid. I'm not telling you my deepest, darkest secrets here.
He's like, right.
And I think it really did. It did cause some problems for him. And I know he had sent several letters and talked to the bishop at the time, and you know, and told him that he didn't feel like he was able to give 100% of what he needed to parish, and he didn't feel like he was able to help the people as much as maybe someone with not that close of contact with him. So that's when he had asked if he could become a chaplain. He had looked into it and wanted to. I think in some ways, because my dad went into World War II, and my dad was about 7 years old, 7 years younger than Father Emil. And my dad went into World War II. He actually was a part of D-Day, went in on the second day. And I think Father kind of saw that he felt his duty was to be there as well, too. He knew he could help a lot more and help the soldiers a lot more in their faith and in anything he could do, way more than anything he could accomplish there in the parish. And
right.
And he was given permission, and he kind of went in at the end of World War II. He was went into the Burma conflict towards the end of World War II, and then came out of that, and actually came back again to Pilsen as the parish priest, and the people loved him. I mean, he was just one of those guys, and just. Then that's how he always wanted to be seen. I don't think he ever wanted to have himself seen as, you know, I'm above anybody. He always wanted to be equal, or actually probably think of himself on a lower level than people around him. And that's what people loved about him. He was just a genuine, kind person. And when he came back after World War II, again, he was back in Pilsen. And that's part of the reason that they always wanted him out there, because of the Czech population. And he was able to talk Bohemian, and you know, he knew the language, and that fit in really well with everyone out there. But then as time went on, again, he had this, the same battles of people knowing him and feeling that he wasn't able to help, you know, as some of his letters had said, he didn't feel like he was able to save all the souls that he thought he could save if he was somewhere else. And then when the Korean War started up, he saw his chance again, and he knew where he needed to be. And once again, asked a bishop to go in as a chaplain. And that's when he ended up going into the Korean War.
And that's what he's best known for, is his service in the Korean War. A lot of people may not have realized that he had also been in World War II. He has a very particular, very distinguished story in the Korean War. Tell us a little bit about that, again, from your family perspective.
Yeah, because he went in at pretty much at the very start of the Korean War, and there again as a chaplain. And you know, that the whole inclination when all this started, everybody thought it was, and it wasn't even considered a war. I mean, you talk to some people today, and they, you know, it's still called a conflict, and there's still some debate on. But you know, everybody went in thinking it was just going to be a short time frame, that it wasn't going to, you know, they were going in early part of the end of summer, and everybody thought they'd be home by Thanksgiving.
And right, that, in and out.
Yeah, exactly. They just thought it was going to be over, and you know, it was just going to be done and finished. And of course, you know, whether the United States was prepared, I mean, there's all kinds of debates on that, but Father went in again to help people, to help the soldiers, to help them get through anything they needed to get through, to be their padre, to be their father, to just be a friend. And it was during that time, it was the Battle of Unsan, was when Father was captured. It was when China had came in and invaded, and everybody had kept saying that they were coming in, and there was a lot of pushback saying, no, they're not going to get involved. And that's when the Chinese overran their camp where they were at. And of course, Father, you know, he was one of those, he wasn't going to, you know, they were told to retreat. They needed to get out. They knew they weren't going to win the battle on that, and were told to retreat. And Father wouldn't retreat. I mean, there was people out there that were hurting. There were people out there that he knew, you know. And then, I mean, they were already hearing rumors about if you were captured and wounded, or if you were just wounded, that you were basically a dead person. I mean, they weren't taking any prisoners if you were wounded. And Father just wasn't going to leave him. I mean, that was just his way, and just how he lived his life. And so he had stayed. He got captured along with quite a few other men. And the Medal of Honor, how it was designated, Herb Miller was one of the men who was also there. Herb Miller had his ankle shattered during the battle. The grenade had went off close to him and shattered his ankles. He wasn't able to walk. And Herb also knew what happened to people that were wounded. So he was laying amongst quite a few dead soldiers, both Chinese and American, and had pulled him over the top of him, trying to hide himself as maybe being a dead soldier. But the Chinese had found him and actually had a gun pointed at his head, and we're ready to pull the trigger. And Father was being held by the Chinese, literally held by the Chinese. And he just pushed the guard away, walked over to Herb Miller, pushed the other guard away, picked up Herb, and carried him over to where they were at. And there again, that's, you know, without even thinking twice. And everybody to this day, I mean, when Herb Miller was still alive and you'd talk to him, he's like, nobody understood why Father didn't get shot, why they just didn't shoot him for what he was doing.
That's amazing. That is amazing. And so that's the event that later, much later, prompted his receiving the Medal of Honor.
Yes, that is correct. Yes, because that all has to be based on actions and during battle and actions in the battlefield. And And that's what they, of course, all the other things and everything that he did in a prison camp. But that's what the Medal of Honor was based on.
That is an amazing story. That is an amazing story. So we know that, unfortunately, Father Capone's story does not end with him coming home. Tell us about that part of his story.
Yeah, like I said, they were captured. They were marched almost 60 miles with, and at that time they didn't have minimal, I mean, they weren't in winter gear because it was in the warmer part of the year and just end of summer, into fall. And they didn't have any winter gear and barely any shoes on their feet, but the whole group was marched about 60 miles to the end where the camp that they ended up at. And during that march, I mean, everybody knew if you couldn't keep up, then you were just shot. I mean, that was just the fact of things. And Father would do anything he could do. And Father wasn't in the best shape himself, but he would carry anybody he could carry. He'd carry him on his back. He'd carry him on his shoulder. And Father was always one of those people who, he wasn't one of those forceful, you need to do this, you need to do that. He did everything by actions. Everything he did was by, he just did it. He didn't ask somebody else to do it. He would just do it himself. And so many men would follow his guidance and what he was doing because they felt ashamed for what he was doing. And if they weren't doing it and letting somebody else die or not carrying them help take the load. So he inspired a lot of people to help. And so that, yeah, they were marched that 60 miles to the camp, became the coldest winter that Korea has ever seen. And like I said, they were very minimal as far as clothing went, as far as winter gear and anything went, very shoes. And in the camp, they were basically starved to death. I mean, in the early times in the camp, that they would all they would get of their rations was called mullet, which is basically bird seed, and it wouldn't even be cooked. I mean, it would be like going out to what you feed your birds. I mean, that's pretty much what they got.
Oh my gosh! Oh wow!
And it was nothing much more than probably like, if you were measuring it, probably like a cup a day is all they were getting. So, you know, the men were all getting scurvy. The men were all starving to death. They were all freezing to death. I mean, the conditions in that camp were so horrendous. I mean, you talk to the guys today, and actually there's only two that are still alive, Mike Dow, who lives in Houston, Texas, and Paul Roach, who lives in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Both of them are 97. But when you talk to them, and I've been blessed and fortunate enough to know them dearly and consider them family, but they still tear up and talk about how bad the conditions were and what Father did to help keep them alive, basically, and give them some kind of hope of possibly getting out of that camp eventually.
Yeah, the way that you talk about it, it sounds amazing that there were survivors at all. So with everything that he did through, you know, I know the Medal of Honor came second to what we're about to talk about, but through all of his actions, the Catholic Church has named him a servant of God. What does that mean for those of us who are not Catholic or may not know about the sort of the workings of the Catholic Church?
So basically the servant of God status is the first step to possible sainthood. They saw how he lived his life, you know, from early on through the priesthood, through being a chaplain, saw his life as how he lived his life, as giving everything to the church and giving everything to God. He never thought of himself. He never put himself first. It was always others. And when the POWs came out of the camp and started talking about all that he had done, and I do this all the time whenever I give a talk to anybody, I always attribute Father's story to the POWs because they came out of that camp and continually talked about Father. I mean, they would tell everybody about what he did for them and how he saved their lives, and they wouldn't be alive today. And to be honest, if it wouldn't have been for those guys and the insistence of telling the story and making sure everybody heard the story, father, and it, you know, it would have been more than just a casualty of the Korean War for us and for my grandparents, because my grandma just, I mean, she never gave up hope that father was going to come home, even when she finally realized that he had died in the prison camp. But she always thought he would come home. But it was the POWs that kept telling that story, and we really would not have known anything about father if they wouldn't have came out and talked about it. But right now he's in the first steps, a servant of God. The next process is venerable, which that is being talked about very heavily right now. And they've already gone through the research as far as possible miracles attributed to people praying to him. They've got two that are very, very likely to be stated as a miracle, because there's no other way the recoveries could have been without some miracle taking place during that process. Of course, the sainthood process is not a race to the finish line. It's a very slow and methodical and very investigated process. So as somebody said, it's definitely like pushing mud uphill.
So is there anything about Father Capon that we haven't talked about today that you want to make sure everybody knows about?
Just his giving. I mean, it's been kind of interesting. Of course, like I said, we were identified. I was contacted in March of 2021 that they had identified his remains, because it really was thought. I mean, all the POWs, even Mike Dow and Paul Roach, all said the same thing, that when he died, he was buried in a mass grave. I mean, it was cold. It was ground was frozen, and there was one person, Henson, who said that no, he said, I buried him in a grave by himself. But all the others are like, no, he's not right. Everybody was buried in a mass grave. And that actually came to be true. I mean, it was really kind of interesting, because when I called Mike Dow up and I called the POWs that were still around when they had called and I said they identified father's remains and wanted to let the POWs that were still alive to know. And Mike was just like, well, it's true. He goes, I feel bad. He goes, it was true. But when I think of how times are right now and the way things are in the world, and my wife always keeps saying, she always keeps saying that, you know, father was ready to be found. Father was ready to come home. You know, we may not know why in our lifetimes, but, you know, I try really hard to, and I don't even come close at all, but try to live in at least atone to what his life was and how he gave his life for others without even a second thought.
If nothing else, it's a good news story. He was able to be identified and able to be brought home and laid to rest. And that in and of itself is a good news story. And anything on top of that, I feel like is, I don't know, a bonus almost. So yeah, the fact that these good things that have been able to happen because of his sacrifice, it makes for an amazing story, which is one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about him as the first service member arc in our new podcast. So I definitely appreciate you being able to come on and tell his story from a family perspective.
I appreciate that. And like I said, I'd love telling his story, because like you said, it's an amazing story to start with. And it really does pull at your heart, and it makes you stand back and look at how you're living your life and just the things that he did and how it affects other people. I mean, I guess that's what I see more than anything else, is when people read his story or find out about his story, but just how much it affects them. I mean, he was, for being a small town Kansas kid, he is touching everyone around this world. That is for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Ray, thank you so much for coming on and talking to me and being on this episode of the podcast. We definitely appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll hear from you at some point in the future. Especially, we'll need updates on his process of potential sainthood for sure.
Oh, definitely so. Yes, definitely. And yeah, I definitely appreciate you getting in touch with me and anytime, at any time at all.
Thanks so much, Ray.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for coming on this journey to learn about Chaplain Capon. We hope you keep coming back as we continue to explore the stories and science behind DPAA's mission to fulfill our nation's promise. Speaking of science, our guest next time will be Dr. Tim McMahon, the director of DOD DNA operations at the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System. We'll dive into how DPAA partners with Tim and his team to use DNA as one of our most important lines of evidence in making identifications. We hope you'll join us on the next episode of Missing and Not Forgotten.